The Lindsey Clancy jury asked questions about evidence and deliberated all day. No verdict. The jurors, not sequestered, returned to court Monday morning. The Iran war is 6 months old today, and with it, new economic sanctions announced. But the stalemate few envisioned then continues now. After 9/11, America realized it failed to imagine, detect, and prepare for new threats. Some in Congress are trying to do that work now. Rick Crawford, head of the House Intelligence Committee, joins us to unveil a new report on dangers ahead. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. The jury in the Lindsey Clancy murder trial has been sent home after asking questions today about Clancy's medication and the knife used in her suicide attempt. Our Chanel Call is standing by, and we will be with her momentarily. But we're going to begin with the Iran war because it started 6 months ago today. It was supposed to last, you'll remember, 6 weeks. The three reasons the war started: Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, its ballistic missile program, and its support for terrorist proxies, much more distant now than then. Sure, President Trump, when he talks about the war at all, which isn't very much lately, repeats that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. But little new damage on Iran's nuclear facilities has been inflicted during the course of this war. And Iran retains its stockpile of highly enriched uranium. Clearly problematic. As for ballistic missiles, well, Iran still has some, but its abilities and capabilities quite clearly have been degraded. It also continues to build and deploy drones, harassing neighboring Gulf states at its whims. And Iran's terrorist proxies still operate in Yemen, Lebanon, and Gaza, frustrating the U.S., Israel, and Gulf allies. Newly aggressive U.S. economic sanctions are raising alarms in the region. They did so just today as banks scramble to avoid or minimize their impact. Iran's theocratic regime, though differently constituted after senior leaders, including the supreme leader, were killed in the war's early stages, well, it remains in power. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, though battered, retains power inside Iran and continues to menace the Iranian people. We should remind ourselves of what Trump said about that Guard Corps when he launched this war.
To the members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the armed forces, and all of the police, I say tonight that you must lay down your weapons and have complete immunity, or in the alternative, face certain death.
That hasn't happened. And with the U.S. turning from military action to economic sanctions, this particular threat from the president reads charitably as inoperable. And what about what Trump said to Iranians brutalized by this regime?
I say tonight that the hour of your freedom is at hand. Stay sheltered. Don't leave your home. It's very dangerous outside. Bombs will be dropping everywhere. When we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. This will be probably your only chance for generations. No president was willing to do what I am willing to do tonight. Now you have a president who is giving you what you want. So let's see how you respond.
When we are finished, no one knows when that will be. One thing appears to be clear: the Iranian people more desperate and dispirited now than then. They are victims of repression and raging inflation and growing increasingly cynical, the New York Times reports, about American intentions and follow through. The only metric of this war's success appears to be the Strait of Hormuz and how many vessels are moving through it. The U.S. this week touted numbers far higher than public databases, raising questions about their underlying accuracy. The U.S. also says all mines have been removed. That might be true, but anxiety prevails among shipping companies, and the numbers tell the story. One vessel has transited the Strait in the last 24 hours, down from a pre-war number of 60, though on some days that number often exceeded 100. There are nearly 200 tankers waiting to move. And perhaps the most telling number of all, the insurance risk premium has risen 50% since the war began. This is why world oil prices and gas prices here remain elevated and domestic inflation persists. It's worth noting that Trump's new Federal Reserve Chairman, Kevin Warsh, said today that inflation is concerning, saying so months after Trump promised the war would soon end and that energy prices would, remember this quote, fall like a rock. 6 months with some of the receipts on this conflict. Margaret Brennan will join us soon to discuss all this, but first, as promised, Chanel Call with the latest on the Clancy trial. Chanel, we have been leaning on you all week long. It's been a long week for you. Summarize what happened today.
Well, Major, today, jurors asked the judge a question. They asked for evidence in this case. They wanted to see up close and personal a couple of items that were already submitted during the course of this weeks-long trial. We're talking about the knife that Lindsay Clancy used to try to harm herself the night she killed her three young children, and two bags of pill bottles. This is pretty common, Major, in jury deliberations, that if the jurors want to see some of this evidence up close and personal, they have to put in a request with the judge, and then the judge will respond. In this case particularly, we're talking about 21 days of testimony, a huge tranche of evidence, so this could come up once again.
And there are lots of things the jury has to weigh. What was the atmosphere outside and inside, if you can summarize?
I mean, outside and inside, the court has been largely quiet, with the exception of the large volume of media here covering this trial, Major. I will say, you know, we've been showing you all photos of these women that showed up day after day during those testimony days wearing pink to mark their support for Lindsay Clancy. That is really the overwhelming sentiment that we've seen here in Plymouth up until just a few moments ago, late this afternoon. Far-right activist Jake Lang showed up. He was just behind me right in front of the court here in Plymouth. He had a megaphone. He had some pretty graphic signs and was using quite violent language as well. The security here did escort him off the premises. He is still here on the lawn in an area where he's now allowed to be, not far from us. So I'm not sure if you can actually hear him in the background here. And while that moment was a little bit chaotic but brief, I think, Major, it does mark this moment where we are seeing, you know, tension and debate around this particular case rising.
Chanel Call, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Brennan joins me to discuss the Iran war at 6 months. She is, of course, also moderator of Face the Nation. Well, you heard my summary at the top, Margaret. Lots of other things. And I want to particularly talk about economic sanctions. There was news today from the Treasury Department about a particular financial institution, the United Arab Emirates. And then the Egyptians said, whoa, wait. Was that our bank or related to our bank? The repercussions in the region seem to be visible.
They are. And there is concern whenever, you know, further financial punishment that's targeted hits, because there are always ripple effects to that. So this isn't nothing, right? But the question is, does it actually make a difference? And in the 6 months of this conflict, it's not just what has America done to Iran, but what has this conflict done to the United States and its position in the world? We talked last Friday about the fact that this country pulled its aircraft carrier from the Asia Pacific to make up for need in the Middle East. We're talking about America's stockpile and ability to defend in other theaters as well. And so this is of concern on many fronts to the national security community in this country, because it's not just what more can be accomplished to actually do all the things that the president laid out there. And on that list of goals, most of them have not been achieved, as you made that point. But then that shows the limits of American military power. It shows the limits that this president is willing to go to. And that sends signals to President Xi and President Putin. So it is worth us talking about the implications of this coming to this complete murky spot with no definitive diplomatic deal. I am told, to be clear, that there is outreach again from Iran. And that they want more than nuke talks. They're looking for some confidence building measures, but it's not clear whether there's interest on the other side.
It's also worth noting, Margaret, 5 years ago this week, the United States pulled its final military personnel out of Afghanistan, and it didn't go well. You had a conversation with a former chief of staff of the Afghan army. What did he tell you?
You know, Major, this is a conversation we continue to have on Face the Nation, what the implications of that 20-year conflict have been for America, but also for America's veterans who are still trying to make sense of what was it all about? Why did they go? Why did they lose their loved ones? And for Afghan vets, it's the same thing. You know, for this general, he, 4 days before Kabul was taken by the Taliban, was given the job of coming up with a plan to keep them from sweeping the country. 4 days beforehand. He was head of special forces. He details for us in this conversation what that was like, and trying to defend his country he thought was still worth fighting for. So when you heard President Biden at the time say they didn't have the will to fight, hurt by him. I want you to hear something, because he's here in the United States now to make ends meet. Like many immigrants, he's driving an Uber.
Driving
he might actually
Uber.
Sit behind his wheel. And he spoke to us.
Wow. It will eventually happen. Look, the way Taliban are dealing, the way Taliban are treating Afghanistan. Afghanistan people are different people, as every nation is different. Afghanistan people can take the stress of financial collapse. They can take the stress of political collapse. They can be killed. They can be tortured. They may not even raise their voice. The things the Taliban are doing to Afghans, it never happened historically. Beating up the women, that's Afghans, they don't tolerate. They will never ever forget that. Taliban are doing stuff that they are almost going to a gradual collapse. That's one thing. Second thing is Afghanistan's young generation who just started, and they will not give up on Afghanistan. And we all believe that Afghanistan under Taliban will not continue, and it will not be healthy for any Afghan to have Taliban ruling Afghanistan.
So 5 years later, he still has dreams of going back and retaking the country, perhaps for his children, who he has not seen in 5 years because they can't get a visa to this country since our government does not allow Afghans to come here, including the children of asylees. He has an asylum. He is seeking a green card, but the government won't allow his wife and three children to come here. And he can't travel there to go see them and know that he'll be allowed back into this country.
Right. So he worries about the future of his country, but also more intimately the future of his wife and children, because they live under some manner of threat under the Taliban.
Well, they are in India. They did escape Afghanistan,
okay.
But he can't get them here.
Okay.
It is just a statement in terms of our current immigration policy that those who fought alongside our military and bled for these purposes, they're treated differently here now. They do have status and protection, some of those who held the positions, but that doesn't necessarily extend to their loved ones and to their family. And that's something I know a number of lawmakers are concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not a lot of progress yet.
Or political pressure. I'm glad for the clarification.
Yes.
I'm glad they're in India.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Brennan, thank you very much. You can watch Face the Nation this Sunday on CBS at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. This weekend, Margaret will talk with Congressman John James, Republican of Michigan, and Senator Richard Blumenthal. Joining me now, CBS News foreign policy and national security contributor H.R. McMaster. He served as one of four national security advisors during President Trump's first term. H.R., always a pleasure to have you on the program. Give me your assessment 6 months in of a war that was supposed to last, the president said, about 6 weeks.
Hey, Major, I think when we look at this in retrospect, what we're going to conclude is that the cost of not acting at the initiation of this phase of the 47-year-long war would have exceeded the cost of acting. Now, it's been, you know, kind of a inconsistent path to get to where we are today, 6 months later, after the initiation of that U.S.-Israeli campaign against Iran directly, against their leadership, against their tools of repression. At the outset, you said there hadn't been any losses on the part of the Iranians. Man, I don't think that's true. I don't, you know, Major, I mean, maybe you misspoke there. But, I mean, there have been, you know, at least 6,000 killed in the Iranian security forces, those who had murdered 30 to 50,000 Iranians in January of this year. And they've had about 16,000 wounded. The tools of repression by the regime are weakened as a result. But hey, you know, they just have to be stronger than any organized opposition. And as you've been seeing and has been reported, You know, they're still executing a number of people every day just to keep the population down. But now you have the economic pressure. And this is what I think is going to make a big difference, Major. I mean, I know there's it seemed, you know, that your monologue there at the outset was skeptical. Hey, I think Iran is in a much weaker position than we've been reporting. And I think it's pretty clear that the global economy can weather this storm. I mean, not without cost, but I think the cost of trying to appease the Iranians would far exceed the cost of seeing this through in terms of choking off the resources the regime needs to rebuild its ability to project power outside of its borders.
Yes, I take all those points. And I never said that there were no injuries or deaths in Iran. I said the regime is weakened, though it's still clinging to power, and the Revolutionary Guard Corps also depleted, but still able to menace its people and bother the region. So I think we're in general agreement on our sense of what is and may be in the future. But let's talk about China and the economic sanctions. They said today they violate the United Nations Charter. They're not going to participate. There are some concerns in the region about how much these sanctions will bite. I know economic sanctions can work, HR, but they were an available option before this war started. Now they're coming in after the war did not achieve all of its stated aims. So are they going to work?
Yeah, I think they could work as part of what we're seeing coming together here now, finally, Major, is an integrated strategy that is combining, you know, the blockade on Iranian oil exports and military activity with a whole range of financial and economic actions to dry up the cash flow that the regime really desperately needs to pay its security forces, for example. You know, their currency is at an all-time low at this point. And because of the blockade as well, what you're seeing is real pressure in terms of fuel supplies. You have really these long gas lines. And remember, you know, it was people's anger over the mismanagement of this economy, the mismanagement of this country for 47 years that brought people into the streets in January. So now I think this is like the triple source of pressure now, internal to, on the regime, economic pressure, and military pressure as well. Now, is that going to result in some kind of an agreement from this regime that we could live with? I don't think so. And the reason, Major, is the ideology that drives and constrains the regime and has as one of its features permanent hostility to the great Satan, you know, the little Satan, Israel, its Arab neighbors. There's a lot that can be done with China. I think after the September 24th Xi Jinping visit, I think you could see some secondary sanctions on maybe smaller Chinese banks, some other actions. But hey, there's a lot to do in the UAE, Major, who was operating under the false assumption that if they acted as Iran's banker, maybe Iran would treat them okay. Well, they didn't. They fired 3,000 projectiles at UAE in this war.
H.R. McMaster, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Hey, great to be with you, Major.
Still to come, as we approach 25 years since the 9/11 attacks, the House Intelligence Committee has a new report on emerging threats in the era of artificial intelligence. The committee's chairman, Congressman Rick Crawford, joins me with a first look. Also, a federal judge temporarily blocks the U.S. Postal Service from moving ahead with new vote-by-mail rules. A look at the legal battle and the confusion it is imposing on election preparations. Plus, with the end of summer and the beginning of a new school year comes a somewhat new ritual, fantasy football drafts. We will preview the players to land and the ones to avoid. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds.
Matching outfits, extravagant birthdays, many nicknames, a few classic moves of a dog-obsessed parent. At Ollie, they're obsessed with how obsessed you are with your pup, which is why they obsess over giving your dog the best. Ollie's fresh, human-grade recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. The meals are perfectly portioned and come with a puptainer and scoop for easy storing and mess-free serving, delivering the best experience for you and your pup. And through the Ollie app, you can actually check in on your dog's health with real vets. By uploading a picture, their team can check your dog's weight, digestion, teeth, and coat. They'll then provide next steps on how to keep them thriving. And because they're just as obsessed as you are, there's zero judgment if you check in every day. You could say Ollie feeds the obsession. Go to ollie.com/firstbox and use code FIRSTBOX to get 70% off your welcome kit. Ollie, feed the obsession.
Welcome back to The Takeout. 2 weeks from today, this nation and much of the world will mark 25 years since the 9/11 terrorist atrocities. National security threats have evolved, quite obviously, over the past quarter century. And the House Intelligence Committee has done an assessment in a report it's releasing Monday. Arkansas Republican Congressman Rick Crawford, who chairs the Intelligence Committee, joins me now with a preview. Mr. Chairman, always a pleasure. What did you learn? What are the emerging threats?
Let me give you a real quick statement here. I think the post-9/11 reforms worked, but the danger is believing that means the work is finished. It's not. We've still got things we have to do, and that's because, as you indicated, we have an ever-evolving threat landscape that really wasn't considered in the immediate aftermath of post-9/11. So we have to recognize that we have to be diligent on all fronts. That is to say, we have new technology that wasn't a part of the landscape in that era. We have a more well-developed terrorism threat, but our counterintelligence posture needs to be shored up as well. So there's an awful lot to talk about. I think, by and large, the implementations of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission back in 2004 were pretty well done, but that doesn't necessarily mean we should congratulate ourselves and say, mission accomplished. We always have to be diligent constantly reviewing what threats are out there. Our adversaries don't organize around our bureaucracy. They organize around our vulnerabilities. And so we need to make sure that we recognize those vulnerabilities before they do.
What did you learn? What did the committee report learn about artificial intelligence and drones? Because I believe they fall squarely into that category you identified of new and emerging threats.
So separate and apart from this report, That is a lane that we are definitely going to have to go down to make sure that our IC and in fact, our entire enterprise, Homeland, all of our federal agencies are not only sharing whatever they have, whatever they've learned among themselves, but reaching out to our state, county, local, tribal government entities and our private sector. Because what we're seeing is using technology to go after critical infrastructure, cyber attacks. We didn't have the scale of cyber attacks back in 2001, didn't even exist, wasn't even on the same level in context with what we have today. We didn't have the cyber threats to critical infrastructure that we have today. We didn't have AI. We didn't have the persistent drone threat. And so now we not only need to share amongst federal agencies, but we've got to reach out to our counterparts at every level of government and engage the private sector as well. The tech industry, critical infrastructure, you name it, we've got to have a comprehensive approach and share constantly.
You talked about sharing intelligence, Mr. Chairman. Earlier this summer, Reuters reported that the CIA had cut back what it was sharing with the National Intelligence Director, Tulsi Gabbard. Do you know if that's still going on under the new head of the Director of National Intelligence? And did that trouble you then? And would it be symptomatic of persistent problems now?
It would be troubling. I don't know if that continues. And I will tell you that the new DNI, Jay Clayton, has been on the job for a period of just 2 or 3 weeks. He will actually be in attendance as our invited guest at Shanksville. So we're looking forward to that interaction with him. We'll have an opportunity to discuss many things. And I just met him just a few weeks ago. So we have a developing relationship. I'm looking forward to working with him as the new DNI. And so I'm going to reserve comment on what his relationship is with the director of the CIA as it applies to that sharing relationship. But I'm sure that they all realize that this is a one team, one fight approach. And so I don't have any reservations there.
It was said after 9/11, Mr. Chairman, that there was a failure of imagination, a siloing of information, and an underappreciation of the terrorist threat on America itself. We were aware of it elsewhere. We did not imagine it here. You said some of the post-9/11 lookbacks and reforms have worked. How would you evaluate those flaws found in the immediate aftermath of 9/11?
I think we have for generations felt somewhat insulated from foreign threats because of geography. That is to say, we've been protected from threats because of the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, our ability to secure our border on the south, Our neighbors to the north have been friendly. Historically, we've never had a problem with Canada. So, you know, we just sort of kind of, you know, didn't think about the potential for threats that may emerge to the homeland. But 9/11 changed everything. It changed the calculus tremendously. I mean, we have a Department of Homeland Security now as a result of that. We have a Director of National Intelligence as a result of that. We have a National Counterterrorism Center as a result of that, a direct result of terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. So the failure of imagination has been highlighted for a long, long time. And that's why I say that we really have to red team ourselves constantly and be diligent and vigilant against these persistent threats, not only in the terrorism space, but also in the counterintelligence space. And so I think that's what we're looking forward to, sharing this information. Congratulations where it's necessary, but we're not resting on our laurels, nor should the U.S. government. We should always be cognizant of the fact that we can't allow yesterday's successes to become tomorrow's complacency.
Mr. Chairman, the president sometimes suggests that the greater threat to American citizenry is internal through political divisions. The sum total of our conversation, I gather your committee and you yourself are focused on external threats. Would that be true?
Sure, we are. We obviously, you know, 9/11 was an external threat. But where we see challenges is, you know, to your point, are the internal threats here with regard to things like counterintelligence. What we know are nation states like Iran, Russia, Cuba, North Korea, China, most predominantly, that present a huge counterintelligence threat to security here at home, as well as abroad. But you know, we have to be very, very cautious. And we have to, I think, leverage every asset that we have across the entire enterprise to address the counterintelligence threat as it presents itself today, because I don't think one single agency is adequate to be able to mitigate the threat posed by counterintelligence in 2026 and going forward. We have to find, we need to augment every effort through the best athletes that we have and get them on the field.
House Intelligence Committee Chairman Rick Crawford of Arkansas. Appreciate it, sir.
You bet. Thank you.
Next, in Nepal, at the site of a massive avalanche and flood, the race to find survivors is complicated by fears of more flooding. And the death toll, sadly, keeps rising. We'll have more on that when we come back. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Here's a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. Officials in China and Nepal say they are afraid of risks of flooding, and those fears are slowing efforts to find survivors after Wednesday's avalanche disaster. These officials warn of a new lake, believe it or not, that has formed, and are telling people in certain areas to seek safer, which usually means higher ground. More than 575 people have been killed, and approximately 1,500 remain missing. The U.S. State Department says 90 Americans are among the missing in Nepal and China. It's on the border there. President Trump awarded the Congressional Space Medal of Honor to the four crew members of the Artemis II lunar flyby mission. The astronauts took part, you'll remember, in a 10-day mission around the moon in April, becoming the first to travel beyond the moon in more than five decades. The ceremony took place at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. President Trump also announced plans for a new U.S. Space Academy. A federal judge temporarily blocked the U.S. Postal Service from enforcing new mail voting requirements for the upcoming midterm elections. The new Postal Service guidelines were a response to an executive order from President Trump. The judge delayed the restrictions for 2 weeks, saying that the new rules are likely unconstitutional. I want to bring in CBS News election law contributor David Becker. He's also the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research and the co-author of a most excellent book called The Big Truth. All right, folks, we're going to go through this on mail voting because these things are complicated, but we have some maps for you to help understand the timing of when states, under their laws, will send out mail or absentee ballots. So some states will do this 45 days before the election. Jorma, if you call that map up, those are in orange. The states, 45 days before the election, you see in orange. 45 days before the election, also in... So, wait a minute. Let me start again. It's even complicated for me.
It is.
More than 45 days before the election, that's in orange. In green, you see there, it's 45 days before the election. See? It's complicated. Now, let's go to the next graphic, because this is when states will send out mail and absentee ballots, either 30 or 45 days before the election. Those are the ones you see in blue. And then in purple, these are the states that will send out mail or absentee ballots less than 30 days before the election. We got through that, David. Yeah. These dates are important because all the states, whatever their timetable, have to get this stuff done in order to mail them out properly.
Yeah, what those maps show is we're on top of this. The election is happening right now as we speak. Ballots are being printed if they're not already printed. Ballot envelopes are already printed long ago. The preparations for sending these ballots are already going on. And that's in addition to all the other things that we're talking about in terms of preparing for an election, training poll workers, finding voting sites for early voting and election day. All of those things are going on. And what we also should note is that every state under federal law has to send out mail ballots to military and overseas voters by 45 days before the election, which is the middle of September. We're talking about roughly 3 weeks from now. So this is all happening on top of us. It is just, I mean, no matter what kind of changes you're talking about, good or bad, and honestly, the executive order is not, well, it is not appreciated by election officials. It will not help them do their job. But good or bad, it is way too late to be implementing massive changes.
And yet the Postal Service has these three rules that there has to be ballot design and review standards that states have to adhere to, pre-election notification of how they're doing it, and then a mail absentee ballot list that the Postal Service has to receive from them. And yet these rules say this all has to happen 90 days before the election. Well, we're 70 days. Before.
It's already past the deadlines
they themselves.
Passed. And imagine now the Postal Service, which is already having difficulty meeting its core responsibilities. It's already having problems closing facilities, et cetera, being given all of these additional responsibilities, which it has no competency or expertise in, to try to assess mail voting envelopes from not 50 states, from 10,000 jurisdictions that could be different, that are already printed. If they don't like those envelopes, it's not like the jurisdiction has an option to go and like reprint envelopes all of a sudden now. It is just too late. Now, whether this is a good idea for future elections, I think the courts are going to find that it's still unconstitutional and it's a bad idea. But regardless, right now, it's way too late. And what we should understand is I think the courts are going to find that's the case. We've got this temporary restraining order right now from the court in Boston. Next week, they're going to hold a preliminary injunction hearing, which will formalize that injunction, which I think that court will do. The government has appealed. I don't know that that's going to really go anywhere. If the injunction is issued, it'll get appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals and then presumably the Supreme Court. But now we're talking about being in the end of September, beginning of October, when thousands, if not millions, of ballots will have already been sent out.
And when the Supreme Court ruled 6-3, a week and a half ago on this matter, several friends of mine texted me and said, oh, my God, what does that mean? Has the Supreme Court decided that Trump is going to get his way on this? I said, no. All the court said was no rules had been propounded, so there was nothing to litigate over. Now there is.
Yeah, very clearly. I mean, in fact, kind of ironically, a few days before the Supreme Court issued its opinion, the Postal Service had published its final rule, and that final rule clearly indicates what they're doing. That's the rule that's clearly being considered by the courts right now. This technical procedural issue that the Supreme Court ruled on has now clearly been resolved. Now there is something to challenge. And the Supreme Court at the time very clearly said, we are not resolving any of the legal merits on this or the constitutionality or legality of it. Now, that's not to say that they're going to side with the administration or oppose the administration on this, but all nine justices.
But there's a live legal issue now.
Yes. And right now we've got a court in Boston that has very clearly said the plaintiffs, the states, and the voting rights groups who sued are likely to prevail on the merits and will suffer irreparable harm if this is going to go forward. That's the standard. And then preliminary injunction will likely be issued. The First Circuit will consider this. The First Circuit already approved an injunction in this case. And then presumably it'll go to the Supreme Court. But meanwhile, election officials are just doing their jobs. They're getting these ballots out to voters. And at this point, there's just no way to implement this in any way that would that wouldn't disenfranchise voters, create chaos and confusion. I don't expect the Supreme Court is going to embrace that.
And yet, David, because we have experience in this space, it might prove a predicate, though invalid, for some Republicans, including the President of the United States, if they don't like the results of the midterms, to inject some manner of doubt.
Yeah, I'd go farther. I think it absolutely will be a predicate that we'll see them latch onto anything if they don't like the results of the election. But the fact is, we're running the mail voting process in 2026, just like we did in 2024, when Republicans did very, very well, including President Trump himself. And in 2026, President Trump, for all his rhetoric about mail voting, has already decided to choose to vote by mail twice, including at least once when he was physically present in Palm Beach County during early voting when he could have gone and voted in person. So watch what he does, not what he says on these issues.
David Becker, always good to have you here.
Thanks,
thank you
man.
Very much. Coming up, Republican Congressman Chuck Edwards' unconventional defense against sexual harassment allegations. Our reporter panel talks about that. And some poetry references? You're not going to believe it. Next here on The Takeout.
Drink up, baby. Fantasy Football Happy Hour is here to get you wins and have some laughs. Matthew Berry here, and my podcast, Fantasy Football Happy Hour, has the sleepers, busts, and starts and advice you need to win your league. We're diving into the tape, we're crunching the numbers to bring you sleepers, busts, weekly starts and advice. Whether you're defending a title or desperately avoiding last place, I've got you covered every single weekday. The bar is open. It's Fantasy Football Happy Hour with Matthew Berry, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeout and The Takeout Tab. And remember, it's open Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. It's reporter panel time. Joining me now, Oriana Gonzalez covers politics for Notice. Remember, that's News of the U.S. And Sophia Kai covers the White House for Politico. So let's start with Chuck Edwards. Here's a headline. Poetry is not sexual misconduct. What?
What a line. What a line. Let me tell you. You know, it was a
filed little under unexpected.
Yes. And to be, and I'll add to that, that his staff, he actually sent staff to deliver, hand deliver that letter to different congressional offices in an envelope that said confidential. So clearly very important for him to say poetry is not sexual misconduct. A compliment is not sexual misconduct. A lot of that, those kinds of lines there from Chuck Edwards after the House Ethics Committee.
It does not agree with that.
Yeah.
It has a report saying that you did things outside of the rules with your staff.
Yes. The committee found that he violated rules of the House having to do with sexual harassment. This is his last-ditch effort to kind of urge and beg his colleagues to not vote to censure him, which is what the committee is recommending happen to him.
And he's not running for re-election, is he?
As a result of this, he decided that he's not going to run for re-election because the anger, everything that has come after this, the reaction has maybe, not surprisingly, not exactly even the most positive for someone running in a competitive district.
And do we know anything about this poetry?
I mean, we know that he read a poem at a going away party for one of his staffers, and he cried during it. And in the committee's report, some people testified that they felt uncomfortable by that interaction.
I see. Very good. Sophia, you have a piece about FIFA, Josh Kushner.
Yeah, Joshua Kushner.
And Gianni Infantino.
Look, it's spilling into the U.S. courts. It really is. This fight between UEFA and FIFA and this leadership crisis that Gianni Infantino is under is spilling into the U.S. because UEFA, the European competitor to FIFA, has come and
said, soccer federations.
Big yes. Rivals. They've said, look, we need to get information and documents from Joshua Kushner, who's the only person, third party, who knows what the heck happens with Gianni Infantino's plan to sell stakes in the World Cup. That is the thing that everyone has been so fed up about.
Right. Private equity stakes in the World Cup
yes.
in the future.
Yes.
Which Tens has a family connection to Trump.
Yes.
Joshua
Kushner. Joshua Kushner is the brother of Jared Kushner. They're very close. And Joshua Kushner's Thrive Capital was the partner that they teamed up with to sell these stakes. Of course, you know, the plan to sell the stakes has been thrown out. because UEFA and the rest of the world has said, no, like, we really don't want this. Not only do we not like the plan, we don't like the fact that you hatched this plan without anybody else knowing about it. So now UEFA is going to courts in New York, Colorado, and Florida to seek information about this secret plan.
To seek discovery on this secret plan, which could expose who knows what.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of a big deal when you think about how the World Cup here in America, Canada, the United, and Mexico, big success, big draw. Gianni Infantino was riding high.
He could have just taken the W and got riding off to the sunset, but he did not. He did not. He wanted to do more and more and more, and it's really landed him in a position where he doesn't even know if he can win re-election, and that seemed like a sure thing before the World Cup.
Wow. Very quickly back on Chuck Edwards. Do we know how this poetry explanation has landed?
So negative.
Negative.
I'm going to be honest. I mean, we know Democrats obviously denouncing it. We've heard from Republicans like Kat Kamick, for example, who is at the moment leading an effort to reform how the House handles sexual misconduct allegations. She immediately denounced it. And I'll say that a House Republican told me last night that he made a little bit of a joke comparing this to Bill Clinton giving gifts to Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
So I can't exactly say that people in his own conference are excited about this letter.
Right. Did not land well. That's why I love having reporters here. You know so much stuff. Tell the great story. Get it all straight. Cheers.
Cheers, Major.
Ariana Gonzalez, Sophia Kai, thank you very much. Next, as promised, the keys to your fantasy football draft. Our takeout expert will tell you where the traps lie this season. You don't want to fall into them. Trust me, I have experience with that. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Look, we're not hypocrites here. Earlier this week, we had a segment, a lengthy one, on a new report about CTE and player injuries in the NFL. We take that seriously. But look, the NFL is going to go on. The games are going to be played. And if you're a fantasy football fanatic like me, it's crunch time to get prepared for your draft. So who's going to save my draft board? Who's going to blow it up? I worry about this pretty regularly. With help, I'm going to turn to, for help, I'm going to turn to Michael Fabiano, who is a senior fantasy analyst for Sports Illustrated and the host of Locked on Dynasty and the Fantasy Football Forecast. All right, Michael, who would you say anyone in a fantasy football draft should consider a must-have player in that first or second round?
So I want to go beyond the first and second round because I think those are the easier picks, right? I will tell you there is a player I'm very afraid of in round one in a second. But if you're looking at rounds, say, 3 through 5, which is where you start to build the foundation of your team. I love Tedrone McMillan as a wide receiver too. He was the wide receiver 16 last year. I think he's going to be better this year. Emeka Ebuka, and I know he's got the toe thing, which kind of freaks me out too, but as long as there's no setbacks, I think he is this year's Jackson Smith and Jigba in his second year. So I think he could be a top 10 wide receiver. Luther Burden, who is also dealing with an injury. It's a groin injury. He's supposed to be fine for week one. I really think he is a breakout candidate. Quinshon Judkins in Cleveland. If you like to go with wide receivers in the first 3 to 4 rounds, you can get Judkins in round 5. And Jadarian Price, the Seahawks have already put him in bubble wrap. They haven't really used him in the preseason. And he is really, to me, in a line to be the guy in Seattle's backfield until Zach Charbonnet comes back. And Charbonnet, we're not sure when he's coming back from that ACL that he suffered last season.
All I can say about Luther Burden III is Mizzou, which means he's great, because I'm a Mizzou alum.
There you go.
Who is your first round draft trap?
I think it's Christian McCaffrey. And Major, I was wrong about McCaffrey last year. I nailed Barkley. I nailed JSN. I nailed Drake May. I missed on McCaffrey, but I'm still scared and maybe even more so. He's 30 years old. He's coming off a season with 450 touches, and he hasn't played back-to-back full seasons, I think, since he was with the Panthers. And oh, by the way, electric substation, that scares me as well. Josh Jacobs is another player who didn't look like the same player last year, and now he's got all this off-field stuff. I want nothing to do with him. Let's go back to the Niners. Mike Evans, 33 years old. He's been injured throughout camp and preseason. That scares me. Brian Thomas Jr. was a dud last year. I would rather have Parker Washington in that Jaguars wide receiver room. And then Jordan Tyson, again, injuries are an issue. When he came out of college, that was the one bugaboo about him, and he's already hurt. And so even though there's a dip on Jordan Tyson right now, he's the wide receiver 48 based on ADP, I still want nothing to do with him because I just don't know that he's going to stay healthy and be a productive, consistent player in his rookie year. We might have to wait a year before we get maximum production from him in fantasy leagues.
All right, Michael, lightning round. When do you start drafting a quarterback? What round?
For me, it's around 8 or 9 and no earlier because there are too many good ones out there late in your draft.
When do you draft a defense and special teams?
One of the last two picks. And I don't necessarily even go with the top guys. I will tell you one defense to draft, the Chargers. Their first two matchups are cakewalks. That is the defense I've been targeting.
When do you draft a kicker?
I have been getting in fights with people on social media about this. If you can get Brandon Aubrey in round 12 or 13, 100% do it. He has
gotta
been
go, Michael.
A top five tight end. He's been amazing.
Gotta go, Michael. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
You got it.
So, happy Friday, everyone. Breathtaking show as always. This is The Takeout. We are relentlessly curious, reliably civil, and occasionally clever.
The critically acclaimed series, Colin from Accounts, returns for a brand new season.
But what is it?
We're friends.
We are togetherly.
We're friendly together.
With a dog.
Colin from Accounts, new season, streaming September 10th, only on Paramount+.